from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Tanya Mosley. This month marks the 50th anniversary of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. But there's another date you might not know about. It was the day RFK met with James Baldwin and other black intellectuals. But as Baldwin recounted, Kennedy did not understand that racism was also damaging to white people.
It doesn't matter any longer what you do to me. You can put me in jail. You can kill me. But by the time I was 17, you were done. Everything that you could do to me. The problem now is, how are you going to save yourselves?
Michael Eric Dyson joins us to talk about this fateful meeting in his latest book, What Truth Sounds Like. That's all coming up after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Tanya Mosley, in today for Mina Kim. In 1963, then U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy met with some of America's most well-known black artists and intellectuals to talk about combating segregation and discrimination. The meeting was held in New York City in Kennedy's father's penthouse. And on the guest list, writer James Baldwin, Lorraine Hansberry, Harry Belafonte, Lena Horne, and a young activist named Jerome Smith. The intent was hopeful. Police brutality, segregation, and the degradation of black people were topics brought up that day. But the outcome was not what Kennedy or the others in the room had hoped for. We discussed this historic meeting, what was talked about, what came of it, and what we can learn from it. Joining us today is Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University and author of What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
So you've written about race for a very long time. Mm-hmm. What was it about this conversation, this meeting with Bobby Kennedy, that compelled you to delve into our unfinished conversation, as you call it, about race in America?
Yes. Well, it was fascinating to me because it was tucked between the Birmingham campaign, where the ghoulish goings-on of Bull Connor, the commissioner of safety, who unleashed high-pressure fire hoses and snarling police dogs on the flesh of black men and women and children, tucked between that event and the subsequent March on Washington in August 28th, 1963. So in 1963, big events were going on, but this meeting, though little noted, it is spoken about in biographies of either Baldwin or Bobby Kennedy, but it's not given the just due that I think it deserves. And I looked at it because it has everything. It's got black intellectuals, got black artists, you got black activists, you've got white politicians, you got folk agreeing and disagreeing about what's going on. You got folk bitterly arguing over the future of America based on race, and how appropriate is that 55 years later for where we are in America today.
So your book takes us to that moment, to that time in history, mm-hmm. and it was sandwiched between those big events that happened during that time. But give us the impetus of how this all came together, and it happened really fast. So James Baldwin met with Bobby Kennedy, and the two of them decided very quickly, hey, we need to get some people together, because Kennedy was thinking about these issues. Or give us an idea of the landscape there.
Right. Well, you know, Mr. Baldwin had fired off a telegram to the attorney general. I know young people out there have no idea what a telegram is. He didn't swipe right. It wasn't Tinder. It wasn't social media. No such thing back then. It wasn't even a stenciled mimeograph. I know I'm speaking Greek to y'all. So he went tap, 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 went to the wire office and sent off a telegram to the attorney general. You're doing horribly here. This is a shame and a tragedy when we see black people being mistreated. The president of the United States of America, Bobby Kennedy's brother, Jack Kennedy, is not using his bully pulpit to express a moral vision about America around race. Don't just give us public policy, though you haven't done that either. But give us something that is morally compelling that the nation should be adhering to, even beyond the law. So he fired that off a year before they had met in the White House over dinner, gathering for Nobel laureates. And they met each other, liked each other. Let's get together. Dick Gregory had also met with Bobby Kennedy.
He was civil rights activist at the time.
Right, civil rights activist at that time. Still a comedian, probably, but increasingly becoming a civil rights activist. And he was doing both for a while. So Kennedy was having a series of meetings with various groups to determine what direction they should follow. And Gregory said, hey, meet with Baldwin. So all the stars pointed to it. Baldwin had just written a long piece in The New Yorker that became the second part of The Fire Next Time, the most famous black spokesman in America, the most famous writer in America. So Bobby Kennedy reached out to him. He didn't want to talk to the usual suspects, not King, not, you know, Whitney Young and the like. So,
and he didn't want to talk to those usual suspects. Why?
Well, because he figured, hey, they would be beholden to their organizations. I'm not going to get their skinny. I'm not going to get the truth. Right. They'll give me the politically correct version of it. And I have to speak for the NAACP. I don't want to offend what they say. I have to speak for the National Urban League. I have to speak for the SCLC. He wanted people who were free. Like people who were out there with their fingers on the pulse. Mm. If Sean Carter were there, the great philosopher Jay-Z, he would say, "Streets is watching. What are the streets saying? What are they speaking about?"
So Baldwin and Kennedy met, and there's this great scene you have in the book, which I want to ask you too about your research, because it feels like we're actually stepping into those moments.
That's
in the book.
Beautiful.
But so Baldwin and Kennedy meet over breakfast, and very quickly, they decide we're going to compile these people who you say are from the streets to kind of get the real truth.
That's right. They had a meeting out in Hickory Hill in the suburbs of D.C. because Bobby Kennedy, after all, is the attorney general. Baldwin's plane was late. They only had half an hour. And as you say, you know, they hit it off and they said, well, look, I'm going to be in New York tomorrow. You know, why don't you get some of these people you're talking about or whoever's available on your Rolodex, basically, to come join me. And when you're Jimmy Baldwin, your Rolodex is, you know, Bobby. It's Lena Horne. It's Lorraine Hansberry. It's Harry Belafonte and Kenneth Clark, the great social psychologist. And Jerome Smith happened to be in town. Baldwin didn't know that. So he tagged along as well. And that was fateful because he was the linchpin of that meeting.
Yes. So take us in that meeting. They meet at this penthouse and very quickly, Kennedy starts to speak, and it becomes apparent to those in the room what.
Yeah, it becomes apparent. You're not really understanding what the purpose of this meeting. We know what you want. He wanted to talk about the growing rage in black America that was expressed in urban centers, especially why black people were attracted to the black Muslims and not Martin Luther King Jr. or Whitney and Roy and the nonviolent message. There was growing chaos and catastrophe in this nation, a brewing sense of grief that was beclouding black America. So Kennedy wanted to figure out, what can we do? We got to stop that. I don't want them, to find these extremist leaders appealing. And I want to get them back on track. Plus, I want to make sure that the next election, white people are not alienated. So that was the purpose of the meeting. And pretty soon, he also wanted the Negroes, as they were then called, to be grateful to he and his brother for what they had done. And
so this is an important part. I'm sorry to interrupt you. But so he was speaking to them and saying all of the things that he had done on behalf of the black people at that time.
Right.
And the folks in the room took that the wrong way, or it rubbed them the wrong way.
It did rub them the wrong way, you know. And Johnny Gill was nowhere near. Sorry for the poor jokes.
I don't know if others will get that.
That's right. You know, rub you the
people.
Right way, stroke.
Okay.
Just go to the Johnny Gill. Just check it out. But
it's
anyway.
A song. No,
it
anyway.
Is a song. It is a song. Let's give another song. Stevie Wonder, "You Haven't Done Nothing." You think you have, but you haven't. You know, we're not grateful to you because what's happening? Jack Kennedy, the president, is putting on the federal bench people like Harold Cox, who call black people the N-word from the bench. And he promises the governor of Georgia, I'm not going to use federal power to assert the necessity for integration. What? On the other hand, he's telling black people, I'm going to be, you know, putting forth civil rights legislation when the time is right. So they had their fill of it. And Jerome Smith that day, after Kennedy starts, rolls up his sleeves.
This young activist.
Young
Jerome
activist
Smith.
From CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, along with John Lewis, the most storied and celebrated activist of all as a freedom rider, because he was beat to within an inch of his life so many times. This man bore in his body the marks of suffering, as the Bible might say. So they went to that meeting. They were all allied there. And Bobby Kennedy is talking. And finally, Jerome Smith says, you know, you worried about the black Muslims and you ain't got to worry about them. They ain't doing nothing. They're not politically active. Worry about a guy like me. I am to the point now where I'm ready to pick up a gun. What? The devotee of Gandhi and nonviolence, the devotee of Martin Luther King Jr., and the attempt to unmask white supremacy by the suffering of black people? He said, I'm done. I'm finished. He says, and when I pick up a gun, kiss it goodbye. Stunning, astonishing, a bomb drop, so to speak, in that meeting. And Bobby Kennedy tried to pivot toward the respectable Negroes in the room. And Lorraine Hansberry, to her credit, said, look, Mr. Attorney General, there are a fair number of prominent people in this room, but the only man you should listen to is that man right there. They did not let him off the hook.
We're talking with Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University and author of What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, in our unfinished conversation about race in America. In this book, you use this particular meeting because it ended and everyone was unsatisfied at the end. In fact, you write that at the time, Kennedy was sort of just flabbergasted and silenced and didn't know what to make of it and was very defensive of it. Yeah. But you use this to kind of take us to the current day, that was our unfinished conversation and that we still have yet to finish that conversation.
We have not finished that conversation. We've yet to even take it up. And as many flaws and as many foibles and faults as Bobby Kennedy had, at least he had the willingness to sit down and listen. Now, he was forced to listen. He didn't want to, but he sat there. He could have gone. He could have said, look, deuces, I'm out. I don't want to hear any more of this. You're insulting me. I came here in good faith, and now I'm getting attacked. But no, he stayed. And it was important that he stayed because white people are used to being talked to, are used to talking, but not often in positions of power, especially, but not necessarily listening and hearing the grief, suggesting to black people what they might do. Even well-informed, well-intentioned white liberals who think, look, let me share with you some things that you could do. And Bobby Kennedy did that. He said, look, my brother, we're Irish. We're minorities. We came here, but in second generation, what do we have, a president? Bob, and then Jimmy Baldwin said, that's the problem. We've been here for five generations. We ain't got nothing to show for it. So it went from bad to worse. Yes. So that conversation, and let's be honest here, Bobby Kennedy as a white liberal got upset. What did he do? He sicked the FBI on them. He got the dossiers of the people who were there gathered, and if it had not already been started by J. Edgar Hoover, he started them, leading eventually, and Clarence Jones, the great Clarence Jones of this local area here, up at Stanford, the lawyer for both James Baldwin and for Martin Luther King Jr., was a key figure at that meeting, and Clarence Jones was wiretapped as well, and that led to the wiretapping of Martin Luther King Jr. under the signature of Bobby Kennedy. He got mad. He got angry. He did that, but he calmed down. And he finally said, if I were black, I might feel the same way they do. He got his brother to speak about race as a moral issue the way they wanted. And then he eventually himself was transformed to the degree that by the time he died, he was seen as one of, if not the most trusted white man in America to black people.
We actually have a clip of Baldwin talking about how surprised he was about how little Kennedy seemed to understand about the black experience. Right. This is with Kenneth Clark, sociologist Kenneth Clark, shortly after meeting with Kennedy.
Right.
The Attorney General did not know.
You mean the Attorney General of the United States?
Mr. Robert Kennedy. Didn't know that I would have trouble convincing my nephew to go to Cuba, for example, to liberate the Cubans in defense of a government which now says it is doing everything it can do, which cannot liberate me. Now, there are 20 million people in this country, and you can't put them all in jail.
Your reaction to that, James Baldwin, talking with Kenneth Clark specifically about how flabbergasted he was that Kennedy did not understand that black men would not want to fight on behalf of this country.
Right. Especially when their rights were not being protected, that black people who were dying for democracy in foreign theaters of war, where American aggression was trampling over the rights of oppressed people, brown people, people of color throughout the world, around the globe, and then to return here in America with the prospect that their lives would be disrespected. Remember in World War II, black men returning home from the war wearing their uniforms were lynched for having the unabashed temerity to deign themselves worthy of being American citizens. Now we got an idiotic president who tries to punish ball players for their right to speak up and suggesting that somehow they're not truly American. But I digress. So, yes, Baldwin was flabbergasted. And this, after all, is an interview that is done the very night of the meeting. This is immediately after the meeting. This is not, you know, 10 hours later. This is in the immediate aftermath. After they left that penthouse, they got in a cab and went over to the studio to record this interview. And Henry Morgenthau III, who was the producer, was in that meeting as well. So you got real reaction in real time to the devastation of the notion, as Lorraine Hansberry put it, Mr. Attorney General, if you don't understand, young and white and affable and open-minded and ostensibly our friend, if you don't get the trauma and tragedy we confront, then we have no hope that anybody else will. And Baldwin was astonished that Bobby Kennedy couldn't understand that fundamental point. For him, that was a ceiling, Mr. Kennedy. And for the rest of those Negroes gathered, that was a floor. That's where you enter. That's where you start. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning point for grappling with race. And that is an achievement Kennedy had to work up to. They knew there was a great gulf fixed, as the Bible says, between the two sides.
You mentioned that this was somewhat of a, we have today somewhat of a rosy picture of the Kennedys and their legacy mm-hmm. with the civil rights movement. And you right. say that Bobby worked up to enlightenment, so to speak, before he was assassinated. Mm-hmm. Why is it important, though, that we know what led up to that enlightenment, the work that had to be done to get to that point?
So white brothers and sisters today can understand that there's no shame in your game of learning something. You know, we hear about white privilege and white people go, wait a minute. They come up to me, Mike, you got more money. Your kids are better off. How can you talk about white people having privilege? And I say to them, you know what, in Jim Crow, when it was white water fountains and black water fountains, when white kids could go to one school and black kids to another, and the two societies were separate, supposedly separate, but equal, but never equal, it didn't mean that all white people would be rich. It meant that the only people who would be rich, at least most of them, would be white. In terms of the opportunities provided. It didn't mean all white people would get into Harvard. It meant that only white people would get into Harvard who could prove their mettle, their worth, their value. So we couldn't even have the opportunity to prove our worth and mettle. Think about it. When Babe Ruth broke the home run record or set the home run record of, 713 home runs, he didn't bat against the greatest ball players. He batted against the greatest white ball players. So the point is that when white people see that you have to work your way to consciousness, white fragility, white tears, white hurt and pain. I debated Jordan Peterson in Toronto a few weeks ago. And here's a man who talks about black people and other minorities.
And explain somehow. Who Jordan Peterson is.
Jordan Peterson is supposedly the most renowned public intellectual in the world right now, in the Western speaking world, a Canadian professor who's got a book out now, 12 Steps, and he's really a hero to angry young white men. I mean, I hate to be reductive. The incel movement, you know, those who are enforced celibates, you know, they get mad because women won't speak to them and turn them down, so they go out and become mass murderers. I'm being reductive and a kind of cartoonish, but not far off. And I say to them, get some game then. Learn how to spit game at a woman. Don't shoot nobody. Learn how to, hey, how are you? Fine, how are you?
So you guys had this debate. And
yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. I didn't want to get off on that, but I do want to say, if you ain't got no game, don't shoot nobody. Shoot yourself into a booth and learn how to speak. But yes, we had a debate. He was talking about the reality that, you know, people are, you know, victims, and we're talking about ourselves as group members and not individuals, and complaining about this and privileges and so on. And I said, you know, as a white man, you certainly have a kind of privilege that you're unconscious of. It's like the David Foster Wallace story. Two fish are swimming in the ocean. An older fish sees them coming the other way. Good day, boys. How's the water? They swim on and then they go, what's water? Mm. When you're in it, you don't know it. White privilege is that big. It's a universe of possibility. Born on third base, think you hit a triple. Think you can now play for the San Francisco Giants. So the reality is that whiteness has been enabled to be of help. And when we see Donald Trump, we see the manifestation of the lethal logic of white supremacy. A lot of white people think, oh, my God, that's him. That's not us. He's abhorrent. Now, all that may be true, but he is the logical conclusion to the belief that whiteness is inherently better than anything else. And when we look at him, we see that's a lie. If nothing else, Donald Trump proves that. But it's important to understand the climb of Bobby Kennedy to the point of awareness to understand all of us are fragile, human, limited. We all have to be honest and self-critical, no matter what your color, race, sexuality, or gender, or sexual orientation. But when we see him become a better man because he's willing to be self-critical, that's a lesson for the rest of us, especially white brothers and sisters who may think they have nothing to learn about these critical issues.
We're talking with Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University and author of What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and our unfinished conversation about race in America. In reference to President Donald Trump, you said in your book that you think our historic inability to talk about race has left us handicapped to deal with President Donald Trump, a man who talks about race all the time. Right. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, you know, if you ain't used to speaking about it in intelligent terms, nuanced terms, if you're not willing to grapple with the history of whiteness and white blindness and white sensitivity, you know, many white people tell me, "You're just obsessed with race. Jiminy Cricket, stop. Get over it." While you're in a Confederate uniform, by the way. I mean, literally people on Twitter in a Confederate uniform telling me to get over race. Right. And you're there celebrating. How many reenactments of the Civil War do we need? How many more books on Lincoln in regard to that, or the founding fathers, the founding brothers, the founding mothers? And I'm all for history. I love it. I read them.
And Aaron, you're saying, Burr. I mean, what you're saying basically, though, is that they're in their space, in this space, but they're telling you not to focus on race.
Right. Thank you. That's why you're the host and I'm some guy talking. But yes, let's focus. Focus, Michael. And what I'm saying is, yes, that they are enamored of their own particular slice of history. They are addicted to memory, but also simultaneously addicted to forgetfulness. They want to remember their history because they think it's great. But my history seems to be a problem because my history complicates theirs. They think it's about heritage. I go, it might be about hate. They think Native people and indigenous folk deserve to be treated like savages because God sent them here to tame this land and to tame these savages. Indigenous people and others would call it genocide. So yeah, we've been post-truth and post-fact, not since Donald Trump, but since 1619. So yes, it is important for us to grapple over history, to talk about memory, to struggle with each other, to tell the truth. And because we haven't done so, Donald Trump is able to literally get away with murder. And let me add this too, lest people think I'm merely partisan. I hold Barack Obama accountable for some of this too. I'm not saying Barack Obama is accountable for Donald Trump, but gosh darn it, when you had the whip for 8 years, you had the ability to teach white people how to think about race, not condescendingly. There were some white people who were never going to dig you, tan suit or not, tall and good looking or not, greatest smile or not. But you had the ability to tell the truth to America as much as possible and to be responsible as a president to speak to issues that were critical. His failure to do so left a vacuum. Into that vacuum stepped a man named Donald Trump, who's more than willing to speak about race.
Well, Michael, we got to get some calls now to you because I know a lot of people probably want to talk to you. So give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum or email your questions at forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum. We're with Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Tanya Mosley and from Mina Kim. We're talking today with Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University and author of What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and our unfinished conversation about race in America. Right before we went to break, we were talking a bit about President Donald Trump and our inability to talk about race and he bringing up race all the time. But you very specifically also said in your book that we collectively as a nation have told ourselves a lie that the Charlottesville events last summer, for instance, that what happened there was not American, not right. us. But right. you say, indeed, it is us.
Yeah, it is. We say this is not America. This doesn't happen in America. Absolutely, it does all the time. And unless you're blind or insensitive or unknowing and ignorant, and many of us are all of those and no fault of ours, let's overcome those barriers, obstacles, and deficits with the exception of other ableness and using that metaphor of blindness, the reality is that we have refused to know. There's some things we don't want to know. I teach at a Catholic school, Georgetown, and the Catholics have a notion of culpable ignorance. The cop stops you and says you're going 30 miles in a 25-mile zone. And he says, well, there are no signs around, but there's a sign over there, but I didn't know what it meant. Well, when you took the lesson and you studied the book, you're supposed to know what it is. You're responsible for what you don't know. So in America, come on, how long do we have to keep talking? Americans are geniuses at so much stuff, but they just can't seem to figure it out about race. So we have to talk about this, and we have to engage each other. And yes, we have to talk to one another about these complicated issues, but it's not that we don't know. We don't want to know. We have no deep and profound curiosity about this. We're not driven to know. And we're not really used to thinking about race in somebody else's shoes. Can you imagine if the majority of people who were murdered, killed, or otherwise shot by the police were white, young kids who were seen to be worthy of support and they were going down? We would not tolerate this. These are the kind of complicated issues we must have. And in the age of Trump, race is even more difficult to talk about. In the age of Charlottesville, where the president makes no moral distinction between people against fascism and Nazism and racism and anti-Semitism and those who stand for it. This is the trouble we're in. This is why we must speak up and amplify our desire to make this nation a truly just society.
We have a lot of calls and a lot of comments,
right,
so let's get to them. We have James in Oakland. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great.
My thing is, you know, we keep talking in the black community, and I feel that it's time to just take the power. It's time to just say, hey, look, we need to have a grassroots and just take over our cities, take over our schools, just demand, because we keep asking people for permission, and it's time to stop asking. It's time to just do what we need to do and form our own, venture capitalists, our own, our own school system that's going to be equal or better than what they are.
Thank you very much for your call, James. Michael, you touched on this in the book very much so, this idea of bearing witness to trauma and the suffering and talking about it and making it known, are also working on those back ends and saying we're going to become more powerful in the legislative sector and all of those other realms.
Yeah, I have a suspicion that the caller, Brother James, I don't want to speak for him, he's talking about just go, away from those institutions and form our own. But ain't that the problem? What does that look like? Tell me, bruh. How do we take over power? Are we in power in San Francisco now with London Breed, inheriting cities that are filled with trash, the homeless dotting the landscape because of the exigency of mental illness joined to economic downturns in the economy? What about figuring out the small percentage of African Americans in the city of San Francisco? How about the Golden State Warriors leaving Oakland to relocate to San Francisco? How's that for a knock on? Is anything more black power laden than the Golden State Warriors? Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green, JaVale McGee thrown in, and Nick Young for comic relief? Do they have black power? Why don't they start their own team? Hold on. Let's push the metaphor. Why don't they have their own team? You can't. It ain't that simple.
It's not that simple.
It's not just that simple. So my point is, I understand it, but we can have our own schools on Saturday, even within the context of dominant society. Why don't you have schools that teach young kids about their future, their past, their present, that talks about the values we have? So there are many things we can do. But in terms of absolutely just buying out of the system and taking over, first of all, I didn't put too much tax money in the system. I ain't going nowhere. And secondly, the reality is it's not a realistic option. Hate to say it. Now, watching Black Panther is beautiful, but the reason we were attracted to Black Panther is because we all want that. A black universe where blackness is the norm. We're not defensive against white folk. They just don't matter the same way that they, right? It's not, we don't
whiteness
diss them.
Is not the center, is what you're saying.
Whiteness is not foregrounded or the center of the universe, and we got vibranium. As long as we got vibranium, even white folk want vibranium. Now, maybe that's soul, maybe that's hip-hop, maybe that's love, maybe that's the black way of existing and teaching the world. But the thing is that the reason we were attracted to that film is because it articulates and projects our fantasy of living in a universe where that is not the case. And let me end by saying this, but ask some African nations that are predominantly black, what's going on? Ask them about the carnage inside. We don't want to talk about that, right? Because we know the stereotypes about Africa that exist already. Even our former president, who was Kenyan himself, took a long time before he sidled up to those African nations. But the reality is there's truth in the sense, or some of our Caribbean brothers and sisters, where you can run stuff and there can also be problems from within. So having an all black universe doesn't suspend the necessity of having a moral and ethical orientation that allows us to be just and true and fair with each other.
We have quite a few comments.
Okay, I'll slow down. Okay, I'll be real brief. Yes, no, maybe. Okay, yes.
Ford writes, why would KQED have an obvious race baiter like Dyson on the air? After his shameful conduct on stage debating psychology professor Jordan Peterson, if you can call slandering and race baiting debating, you'd think the media would have a moment of reflection. But no, it's full steam ahead with its own postmodernist racist agenda.
Ooh, postmodernist racist. Dude, do you know what postmodernism means? I teach postmodernism. Are you talking about Jacques Derrida? With deconstruction, are you speaking about Michel Foucault, who talked about the insurrection of subjugated knowledges so that peripheral moments of epistemology could be shattered within the context of Eurocentric paradigms? What you talking about, bruh? I got plenty of postmodernism for you. I'm not a person who's a race baiter. He's Dr. Peterson, I'm Dyson. Notice your disrespect. Notice your inability to acknowledge me. And I get a lot of Petersonites writing me. Hey, Michael. Hey, Dyson. Dr. Peterson. Professor Peterson. Dude, I got a PhD from Princeton. They didn't give it to me on American Idol. I had to speak French and German. Das ist verboten. Huh? Je parle un peu de français. That's all I know. Don't ask me nothing else. So the point is that I had to master the linguistic facility to be able to do what I do. I done wrote 20 books. I done put it down. I have a right to say what I got to say. Now, you got a right to call me a race baiter, but show proof of that. Show evidence of that. Don't just sit behind and have digital courage on a radio. Get out there and do something to change the world. And I encourage you to do so. And if you do so, it's a beautiful thing. I ain't baiting race. I'm trying to deal with the issues of racial inequality that makes sensitive white people like you pissed, mad, or upset. And maybe that's a boon to us understanding white fragility and the tears white people cry while running the world at the same time.
We have some more callers. David from San Mateo. Hi, David.
Hi there. How are you?
Hi. What's your question?
Question, comment, really. I agree with the speaker. I didn't get all of it, but I think everyone needs to be held accountable for our history. I'm an immigrant from England, and we started slavery and ended it. We started concentration camps and ended it. I think that the history needs to be open and transparent, and we need to look at ourselves, warts and all. And I agree. I think your speaker is phenomenal. Thanks. That's pretty much it.
Thank you, David.
Pretty much I want to say amen, love you, brother, and keep talking.
We have another caller here. Let me take Valerie. Valerie from Oakland. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I just want to, first of all, thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm a young first-generation Mexican-American, parents born in Mexico, and, you know, firsthandedly experienced a lot of the things that you've recently discussed. So thank you for your work and for setting up the journey for others to fall in suit. I also agree with opening the door for discussing about race with white individuals who are willing to just listen. I've experienced it with some friends of mine who I've had to challenge. So I think that's another thing I appreciate that you highlight. It is important to bring in our allies, and it's important to forgive them when it's forgivable,
right.
If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess a question that I may have is, how can we, with the trauma of being a person of color, continue to do this work without exhaustion? I know community tends to work, but how can we continue to facilitate the flame for progression, not only for us as people of color, but for the entire world?
Yes, ma'am. First of all, thank you for your kind words about me. Secondly, for your deep eloquence in defense of noble ideals that have trickled down to us from great, 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 great grandmothers and grandfathers who have worked against the odds to create opportunity for you and me and others and make this nation a better place. You know, take what you do with deadly seriousness, but never take yourself too seriously at all. Right? The world doesn't depend on us, ironically enough. If we go, others will be there to step in to take our place. So none of us are irreplaceable. And yet we are invaluable in the sense that what we contribute is so important, is so incredibly necessary for us to do our part where we are. But you don't want to burn out. You know, look, I know I get death threats. I take, you know, people call me up on the radio saying horrible things. They write me horrible things, call me the N-word. When they write me, I'm just to the point, just call me Professor N-word or Dr. N-word. I did earn that degree, God dang it. So recognize my game. So the reality is you can't burn yourself out by believing that you alone carry the weight. That's why I think Black Lives Matter is right to talk about self-care. Now, initially, when Black Lives Matter talked about self-care, we were, you know, older people were clowning them. Like, what does that mean? Dr. King stuff. I can't go to Memphis today. I've got to take a mental health break. I can't write the letter on Birmingham. I haven't had my tea. So we clowned him like that. But guess what? When they opened up Dr. King's body at 39 for an autopsy, he had the heart of a 65-year-old man. The stress was deep and profound. So we got to find a way to de-stress. I listen to Luther Vandross. I watch movies. I watch The Godfather. Look how they massacred my boy. You know? I'm smart. I know things. I'm not dumb like everybody says. All right, Fredo. I mean, I love movies, right? So I go to movies. I listen to music. And I think we have to repair ourselves and we have to recharge ourselves. And everything is not, you know, about the fate of civilization hanging on our backs because it doesn't. And yet everything we do moves the needle either in the direction of salvation and truth and justice and overcoming or away from it. So we thank God for people like you, first generation, you know, Mexican who is in this society, you know, struggling against the odds with a president who doesn't like, who hates, who calls Mexicans rapists. This is the kind of dire bigotry we must confront and resist. And thank God that you're out there doing your part. And I appreciate all that you do.
Taking a look at your book, you weave in and out the past and present entertainers. So you use this specific meeting that Bobby Kennedy had with these entertainers and Black intellectuals and kind of weave it into today's intellectuals and today's artists and athletes, Muhammad Ali, and then today Colin Kaepernick. What threads are you trying to weave here? Do you feel that they're the folks that we have today, the Beyoncés and Jay-Zs of the world, are instrumental in bringing this discussion to the forefront in a way that we left off back then?
Yes, ma'am. Only one thing I correct you on. You said Beyoncé and you didn't have a moment of silence. Let me do that.
I know. They've already had that here. You know, there was
I just got to, you know, got to show love to the queen. All right. You hear me, Beyoncé? I got love for you. I did write the introduction to her book, Lemonade, that was reissued. So I got love and respect for what they do. Yeah. You know, look, I wanted to, as you brilliantly put it and succinctly, pithily, but, you know, weave a golden thread, so to speak, between what was happening then and what's happening now. Now, I always gonna hit on young people. Y'all ain't the same. Y'all ain't doing the same thing what we was doing back in the day. That's what old people always tell young people. And then the older people told them they weren't doing the same thing. And then their grandparents told them they weren't doing the same. That's how it goes. This is how we transmit moral knowledge, by telling people. Like, there are some people of your generation that think 90s R&B was the height. Slow down, get off that crack, put the pipe down.
It was. I have to say, it was.
My God, but Marvin Gaye? You're gonna compare the
90s? We're not going to go there. We'll take that offline.
You know why you don't want to go there? Because you ain't got no argument. Because I got Teddy Pendergrass. I got Marvin Gaye for you.
I'm not saying that's where it's at. I'm just saying that.
Y'all 90s ain't got nothing on that. 90s ain't got nothing on that. Boys the Men ain't got nothing on the Temptations. Slow down with that. But anyway, you're so brilliant, so amazingly beautiful, but come on with that knowledge about the 70s. But anyway, so the point is we've got to figure out a way to gin up our humanity, to understand the necessity of seeing what young people do now is in a tradition that continues what older people did. And sometimes we romanticize what the older folk did and we don't appreciate what people are doing now. We love Dr. King, but we crap on Jesse Jackson, who's just been announced that he has a Parkinson's. Jesse Jackson was, what, 27 when King dies? and has carried black people. Now, we have to deconstruct and demythologize the notion of the lone black man doing the work of the people while women and other activists around, but that still can't nullify the deep and profound contribution that Jesse Jackson made. So we romanticize what went on then and don't understand Sharpton and Jackson and what they're doing now. So I think Kaepernick, right here in San Francisco, a very enlightened arena, except I guess when it comes to football, this is the Bay Area with all of the convergence of so many progressive ideas, except on the gridiron. So my point is that, yeah, we got to talk about the relationship between the past and the future and the present, and how young people like Malcolm Jenkins and Michael Bennett and Venus and Serena Williams and Swin Cash and so many others are doing the righteous thing. And I wanted to celebrate that golden thread and weave it a little bit more in this book.
That's
give up
profound.
On that 90s now. Give up on that 90s. You got to give up on that 90s.
Look, I'm a 90s baby, so a girl, not baby, woman, 90s girl.
Amen.
So
now,
anyway,
hip hop was cold in the 90s.
So,
but R&B, y'all second rate.
This
second
is pretty rate. Though profound what you're saying though about how we revise history. I'm thinking about the comparisons of James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates. But looking back and knowing that at that time that meeting was held, Baldwin was not necessarily revered to the extent that he's revered today when we look back in his place during that time.
Yeah, that's a great point. Look, now, at the exact time of the meeting, he was at his crest. I mean, he is at his peak, right? Because it is true that he had just become famous, newly famous. Black people were like, this guy who's doing his thing. And let's be honest, is being a black gay man. You know, we weren't as obsessive as we are now. White evangelicals and other black people trying to go around talking about you ain't going to heaven if you gay and all that madness. So, but he was a man, Byard Rustin, James Baldwin, two of the most prominent gay people who changed the life of most heterosexual and other black people in this country. So, yeah, he was amazing. And Ta-Nehisi Coates has come into his own. Mm-hmm. And people say, well, don't be even comparing him like I'm doing the 70s and 90s, like I'm guilty of it myself, even though I'm right on this one. But the thing is, they're saying, well, Ta-Nehisi ain't James Baldwin. He ain't got to be James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. James Baldwin couldn't be James Baldwin now.
Yeah.
On Twitter, they be dogging his nose. They be coming at his skin. They be trying to crack on him because of his sexuality. Look at what they do to DeRay.
Right.
I ain't saying DeRay is Baldwin. He ain't got to be. DeRay ain't got to be. Figure by it, Rustin, in order for him to be accepted. My point is that Ta-Nehisi Coates is doing what he does. James Baldwin was a leader on the front line as well as a thinker and a writer. Ta-Nehisi Coates is not that kind of leader. Mm-hmm. He's a nerd. That's beautiful. We need a blurred, a black nerd.
Right.
He's writing, but James Baldwin didn't write Black Panther. Installments. James Baldwin didn't do the kind of careful social scientific analysis that he did, that is Ta-Nehisi, in his book We Were 8 Years in Power. So let people be themselves and show who they are. Just like Kobe and Jordan and LeBron, let them all be themselves.
I am talking to Michael Eric Dyson. He is a professor of sociology at Georgetown University and the author of What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, in our unfinished conversation about race. Let's take another call. Steve. I'm sorry, Tolman. Steve, yes, Steve, hi.
Hello.
Steve,
yes,
from Richmond, how are you?
Good, thank you. Hey, Dr. Dyson, good to hear you on the radio, brother.
Thank you, sir.
So listen, what would you say to the youth that are so disillusioned and believing in conspiracy theory that they don't vote, they don't try to join social organizations, they don't try to really get ahead or even think in terms of a cause or helping their people. They're just trying to stay out of the whole thing because they see it as a corrupt, conspiracy-filled, system.
Yeah.
What do you say to those people? Because those are my people. That's where I live. I live in a poor area, and that's generally the belief, is that the system is not made to help any of us. It's made to destroy us. So
how
do you communicate to those people that they should take an active role, that they should vote, that they should care?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, on the one hand, let's be a little bit compassionate, right? Why would they conclude that? Look at who's president right now. It ain't hard to be a conspiracy theorist with Donald Trump in office. There are all kinds of theories and prognostications and reflections we can put forth, for sure. But the problem with that, of course, is that those are the very people who need to be voting. Those are the very people who need to be exercising the leverage of their democracy. But they're being suppressed. Look at what the Supreme Court ruled in Ohio for the Ohio case a couple days ago. where it's all right to purge people. Oh, you didn't vote for one or two times? You're done. So now these people who, if they regain consciousness and conscience and want to vote, they can't even do it if they're in Ohio because the Supreme Court said it's cool to purge it because white right-wing Republicans do not want progressive people or even liberals to vote because they want to maintain their agenda. And voter suppression of black people is a linchpin in their agenda. Don't give them the satisfaction of proving them right. You're self-censoring. You're self-suppressing. Forget what the Republicans are doing. If you go, hey, man, that's the man. That's what white people do. I ain't got no investment in that. You're going to that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You got to get off of your hunches. I came from the hood in Detroit. I know what that's about. It's extremely tough, but you have to use everything God gave you. And I benefited from social activists who were from that hood who taught us to use that, not just voting alone, but voting plus going out in the streets, voting plus being able to organize grassroots movements against injustice. So it's both and, not either or. And we got to convince young people, and I got to come into your hood and other hoods, and you are there already to convince young people it does make a difference. Imagine if we had Hillary Clinton right now versus Donald Trump. Now, all these people who told me ain't no difference between Trump and Hillary ought to eat crow right now because it just ain't true.
We have a comment from Greg. Greg asks, as a 30-year-old white male living in San Mateo, working in San Francisco, my best friend is black and so is my main judo partner. What is the main thing I should be doing for equality?
Well, help him get that black belt or her, number one. Do that, do that. But bless you, my friend. Talk to white people and tell them the truth. If you white people, I don't care how funny I am, and I'm kind of funny. I don't care how good looking I am. I'm not. I don't care how smart I am. I try to be, you know, and charming. Some white people love it. Some white people ain't going to check for it. Like the guy writing about Jordan Peterson, I'm a race baiter. He ain't going to never hear me, but he'll hear you. He'll hear you, reasonable white guy. He'll hear you go, you know what? This is not right. Let's challenge what we know is the truth and make a difference. Go to white communities and make a difference, and then enable young black kids and brown kids that you know through your friends to have to make a difference. Have individual reparations accounts. Send a kid to camp for the summer. Pay $30 of their tuition. Find practical ways in which you can make a difference in the lives of people who are vulnerable. Those two things, talk to white folk, help out the people of color you know, that would be great.
We have Tyler in San Mateo. Hey, Tyler, what's your question?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I have my own comment, but first I want to disagree with the caller earlier, like you guys were just talking about, to call Dr. Dyson a race baiter is just preposterous. I mean, he's obviously intelligent and well-spoken, and it's so important always, especially in this time with this president and his supporters in power. But actually, kind of a good segue from the last caller. I'm one. I grew up in Davis, almost all white community. And what I found throughout my entire life, and I've had this conversation with people my entire life and more recently, and I actually just had it a couple months ago, is when you try to have a conversation with people that they should be empathetic and understand things like the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that, the instant reaction I get all the time is, no, I worked hard for what I have. Why shouldn't other people be able to do the same thing? And it's almost like it's an insult to them, as if I'm undermining what they've done. But the thing is, they're not mutually exclusive. You don't have to either have the belief or the understanding that black people and other minorities are the victims of systematic oppression for years, or you worked hard for what you have. You can have the truth that you worked hard for what you have, but you also have to understand and help other parts of society, minorities and black people, who just simply do not have the same privileges and possibilities that you have. So
Thank you, Tyler.
I get when I try to have that conversation all the time. So,
yes, sir. You said it more eloquently and more insightfully than I could. That's what I was trying to say when I said under Jim Crow, it's not that white folk didn't work hard to get what they had, because everybody couldn't go to Harvard when only white people could go. So you made a distinction among yourselves. But the game was rigged because only white people could go to Harvard. So my point right now is the fact when you get disproportionate numbers of people in jail, in prison, being kicked out of schools early and early, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, and they happen to be Latino or African-American. You know, when we look at the bank practices, we look at steering and redlining, when we look at the lending of money, when we look at the bleeding off of wealth, when we look at the gentrification, my God, even doctors don't give the same medicine to white and black people with the same medical issue. They've done studies on it. So, my Lord, it doesn't take a genius to figure out there are still problems of bias, bigotry, and racism with African-American and Latino people and other poor people than there are with normal, ordinary, average white people. And we just got to own up to that. And maybe they'll hear your voice as you continue to say that and speak that message. Thank you for your eloquence, my friend Tyler.
You end your book saying this. A meeting with a few angry black folk more than 50 years ago taught Kennedy a valuable lesson about listening to what you don't want to hear.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the white privileges. Look, can I tell you something? When I go lecture, and I try to be funny, tell jokes, be self-critical, tell some white people jokes, talk about Taylor Swift, talk about country music, I don't care what it is. The moment I segue into talking about whiteness, there's some white people who get up. Because what it means to be white is you ain't got to hear what you don't want to listen to. Now, a lot of people of color, I go to black churches and talk about homophobia. They be mad, too. They be trying to throw the offering plate at me. Negro will never have you come back here. Right? A black woman in Cleveland, when I was preaching, told me, you're going to hell. I said, I know 25 reasons why I'm going to hell. What you know? How you know I'm going to hell? You preach that God created gay people. I said, oh, my God. And you think I'm going to hell and you're a polytheist?
Right.
You think there are multiple gods. So my point is, figure out a way to understand that partly what it means to be white is you listen to Fox News, you have a self-enclosed world, you just listen to what you want to listen to and you get mad at hearing stuff you don't want to hear. Expose yourself to stuff you don't want to hear and you'll be surprised about what you'll learn.
Michael Eric Dyson will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club at 6:30 on Monday night, June 18th. It is sold out, but there is a chance.
Come on over. We can storm. We can storm it. Come on.
There may be a chance.
Come on. Yeah. We're going to try to set up a satellite. Come on over. We're going to figure it out.
Dr. Dyson is the author of the new book, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. You're telling folks to listen and then listen some more.
Yes, ma'am.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.